The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a one-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
Science fiction and music with Peter Aurelian and John Anelia.
I'm John.
I'm Paul.
And our guests obviously today are Peter Aurelian.
Hi, this is Peter.
You want to say something about yourself?
Isn't that enough? So I'm a fantasy writer. I'm also a musician. I see wonderful ways where these things intersect. I'm looking forward to the next hour talking about it.
Excellent. And, of course, the other guest is John Anelio.
Hi, I'm John. I do music that's kind of based around some science fiction and fantasy stuff. So I also see the connection between the two. And I'm looking forward to talking too. So here we go.
Awesome. Okay, so I thought it would be a good way to open up would just be talk about maybe a couple of our favorite pieces of music that are somehow genre related. And I realized that in doing this show that actually that's a very broad category, because it could be, you know, soundtracks, it could be like, you know, there's folk music, there's just geeky kind of music, there's all this like Norwegian melodic metal stuff that is basically just awesome. So why don't we start with our two guests? So we'll start, Peter. What are some of your favorite works of genre-related music?
Well, you know, I thought about this since we had this idea. And what kind of came to me is that so much of the melodic metal, I mean, there's so many subgenres of metal that we could talk about. I mean, there's Viking metal, for hell's sake. There's doom metal. And so much of it is built around the narrative, the larger narrative of genre, even if there's not a direct sort of real world book corollary. And so there's so much of it that is telling fantastical stories that I think is amazing. A recent, fairly recent album that I'm a big fan of is Imaginarium from Nightwish. I told you, I think in advance, I was going to be sure I brought Nightwish up. They're a recent favorite of mine. But they tell this whole story, and the music is so cinematic. The founder of the band, Thomas, he's a keyboard player, and literally, there's an instrumental version of that album. If you listen to it, you can hear the story and the narrative of this sort of slightly dark carnival atmosphere. So I really enjoy a lot of this genre, and I should say I don't really consider myself a metalhead, but this is a genre I listen to. I consider so much of this genre storytelling at its core, and I think we'll probably talk more about that. But if we wanted to have, there's so many examples of direct corollaries between, you know, a band that's taken something and a novel or a story and created something musical around it. Because I tend to the progressive, I like a lot of what Rush did. They've done songs around Rivendale and the songs around Necromancers. So, you know, they go right to the heart of this with what they do. And I enjoy the progressive nature of metal because I think the orchestration is more interesting. I'll stop there because I know John's got examples.
You know, before I would even get into examples necessarily, I would go back a little bit to, and if you can hear in the background, that's my son practicing the piano. So sorry about that. one of the things that I wanted to talk about is how we sort of arrive at sort of genre influences on music, on current music. And that's just to say that you know, if you go back far enough, you know, you go back to classical composers and you go back to folk music, there is a lot of sort of mythology and history tied into those pieces. So then lots of classical composers would take a myth or an old story and write an instrumental piece sort of based on that. And obviously folk music is sort of recounting tales of battles, and especially into like old Irish folk music and that kind of thing, and telling stories of wars and telling stories of, you know, maybe the myths or religions that, that the people who made the music believed in. That's one way. But when you get into sort of American popular music, and if you want to start, I mean, you could start anywhere, but let's say you even start with old big band and all that kind of stuff. Starting from then on, it's all the songs lyrically, or most of the songs, are about relationships and love and stuff that, you know, most people, you know, can relate to. And it's not really until you get into the late 60s where you start seeing people kind of going against that, not writing just love songs. And I'm reading this book. It's called Louder Than Hell right now. It's an oral history of heavy metal, and it's, you know, kind of talking about how metal in a lot of ways really pioneered that. And, you know, even with something like Black Sabbath, where they weren't writing love songs, they were really reacting against sort of the flower power movement, and a lot of their songs were about the occult. And even though they didn't really believe it necessarily, they just, you know, if you hear interviews with like Ozzy Osbourne and Tony Iommi, you know, they're talking about, we grew up in Birmingham, and we just, you know, we lived a hard industrial life, post-World War II life, and our life was not all sunshine and flowers. So they were trying to kind of reflect that. Sean.
I just wanted to jump in on that thing about the Black Sabbath, because they, I think it was either last month or the month before, there's a show on the BBC called Hard Talk. It's mostly politics, but once in a while they have like musicians and writers and things like that on there. And they actually had, I forget which person they had, from Black Sabbath, and the guy was asking him these very questions, like, you know, what do you think about all of the occult imagery in your work? And he would say exactly that thing. It's like, it's part of an image. It's not necessarily like, we don't like run around like worshiping Satan, but it's very much like it's a part of that genre, the image that they created. And it was really interesting just hearing him talk about that. So if people can find it, I think that they should really go check out that interview. Peter?
Yeah, you know, you say that, and it's interesting to me because one of the popular signs typifies sort of endorsement, enthusiasm for metal is to throw the horns. And a lot of people have now misinterpreted that as sort of the sign of the devil, and that it's, you know, rebellion. In fact, when Ronnie James began doing that just as part of his stage act, it's actually an old sign to ward off the evil eye. So it's actually precisely opposite what a lot of people are kind of using it to indicate. I mean, I think a lot of people are thoughtless about it, and they're just throwing it because it's cool, and that's perfectly fine. I do that. But if you kind of get into even some of the interesting backstory around some of the things that are kind of iconic for the genre, they start in a different place. And I agree, we could go all the way back into Wagner and to Amadeus, you know, Mozart, and talk about the influence of the fantastic. But I think that's a whole nother show.
yeah. I mean, I was thinking that exact thing when you and John were talking about sort of narrative and music, and like almost how like most operas are essentially, at least by our standards, would be our fantasies. You know, I mean, most of Mozart's are basically kind of fun little fantasy stories, or there's even further back and you get all of these really interesting operas where the gods are actually interacting, like, you know, the Greek gods, and you got Zeus, and they like interact with the people. John, I think you wanted to jump in on this.
Yeah, well, I think that's the case. But it just, to me, there seems to be a line where and I think Peter's correct. We can talk about all of that, and that's a whole another show. But I just think it's kind of interesting that when you get to popular music, I can't think of a better way to describe such a general term, but basically the sort of the history of recorded music, which starts at the beginning of the 20th century. It's just, for a very long time, that music, songs were nothing really, very little about anything that wasn't a love song. And it's really, at least from to my knowledge, it doesn't really come along until you get to the 60s. And then you get to the Beatles, who wrote love songs. But I think what happens with the Beatles is they get to their later period and you get to Sgt. Pepper. I think what really sort of leads to everything that we're about to talk about is you start with sort of what I think at the time they would consider psychedelic music, you know, where it wasn't just the love songs. It was kind of weird stuff. And I think sort of the weird stuff sort of set the stage for Black Sabbath, and then Black Sabbath set the stage for metal. And then at the same time, sort of also out of the psychedelic world comes progressive rock. I think progressive rock absolutely grows out of psychedelic music, and particularly English bands, really all of Europe, but most especially English bands. You get like Yes, and you get Genesis and King Crimson. And I think you start getting into where it's weird stuff, but then they're also just kind of also going on to myths, particularly early Genesis. And we talked about this on Functional Nerds recently, and Patrick wasn't necessarily too familiar with early Genesis. He was more, you know, familiar with their later works, which is very pop and sort of what I was just talking about, love songs and everything. But the Genesis albums with Peter Gabriel, and then even after he left for a little while, a lot of those are based on myth. They would take old myths and fairy tales and things like that and write songs and even whole albums out of it, or even make up their own myths as well, make up their own stories. But it was sort of a reaction against just straight up love songs and wanting to go for something a little deeper and a little more interesting. And I think metal and progressive rock grow out of psychedelic music, which is kind of a reaction to the straight up pop songs that were really all we really had for a long time in recorded music.
So in a way, progressive rock came out of the Yellow Submarine.
I think so. I think you can say that. I think a lot of the progressive rock bands of the late 60s, early 70s point to those later Beatles albums as sort of opening people's eyes and saying like, oh, you can do something more than a 3-minute pop song. You can do a longer song. You can do an album length piece of music. But also those musicians that were in those bands, many of them were classically trained musicians. They studied at university. They went to conservatories, or some of the members were, at least anyway. And in a lot of ways, they were very musically diverse, too, because not only were they classically trained, but they were into the jazz of the time. Yes, for instance, you know, Rick Wakeman was a classically trained keyboardist, and Bill Bruford, who was the drummer, was a real jazz player, and Steve Howe was just really into all sorts of stuff. And when Yes got together, which it's funny to think of it this way, when you hear in these sort of documentaries on Yes, Bill Bruford, the drummer, says like, oh, well, I thought I was joining a band that were going to have these Beach Boys type harmonies with me playing my jazz drums behind them. And if you listen to Yes, if you're only really a little bit familiar with this, it's weird to think about that. I sort of see where that's coming from, but it's a different thing than just say like, let's write 3-minute love songs.
Peter?
Yeah, the interesting sort of continued evolution there, as I see it, is the concept album. You know, I'm a big fan of the big band era. I mean, one of my favorite artists is Sinatra, and I could listen to him sing all day. But when you follow the progression John talks about, and you finally get to a place where there's like this specialization where, you know, we're not all singing about the same thing, and we're taking different motifs around which to base story. I think for me, one of the most satisfying music experiences, and why I have a little bit of a love-hate relationship with the digital age and the sort of, you know, a la carte menu system of digital, you know, libraries, is the album experience. And that's the concept album kind of takes that to the ultimate extreme, where there's a complete story that's being told. And you guys all know this. You've listened to The Wall. Hopefully you've listened to Operation Mindcrime. Rush has done this with 2112, and there's lots and lots of other examples. But these are typically narratives, and very often they're fantastical narratives. The things that are kind of taking place in these are very genre related. Even if they're not a metal fan or even a popular music fan, if you've not experienced that, I really encourage you to go out and sit down and listen start to finish to a concept album. And if you're a genre fan, I think you'll start to see the way these things tick and tie together.
Paul, that's you.
Yeah, I just didn't think so. Yeah, my first encounter with genre music was a concert album, as a matter of fact. It was ELO's Time.
Hmm.
Yeah,
and I think one of the things I was thinking about for the last few days when we were going into this discussion was, when I think of the people, the friends that I have in this community online that are science fiction and fantasy literature fans, many of them are also fans of some version of this type of music. I mean, I have a lot of friends that like all sorts of different stuff, and some of it is poppier things. And I like a lot of real poppy stuff too. I like I don't want to say I like everything, but I like a lot of different music. But most people who are into this sort of deeper thought and, you know, sort of thinking about big ideas and myths and things like that, of course they're going to gravitate towards this kind of music, whether it's the progressive stuff or if it's the metal stuff, where the lyrics are go a little deeper, tell a bigger story. Rush is a great example. I mean, I think so many Rush fans are genre readers as well. I think it really kind of goes hand in hand. Because they were the kids in high school who just thought more deeply about this stuff, and that music really reflects it.
Go ahead, Peter. Yeah.
I was going to say, I was reading online, and I found more than one account of early D&D players who were playing box sets back when D&D was first introduced, where a lot of people around the table were metalheads, and the introduction, but you know, to a lot of young gamers, were because some of the early people who flocked there were metalheads. And I find it, you know, there's another whole show that could be done around the whole definition of what is a geek. I had this conversational debate recently with a friend of mine, because I said it's kind of gone so mainstream that I wonder if that's counter to what that original definition might have been. And it was a very esoteric conversation. But relatedly, you know, it's interesting to me that in some ways this whole metal counterculture is a geek culture. Embracing that just as easily as I embrace, you know, my interest in superheroes and dragons makes tons of sense to me.
John?
Oh, yeah, to sort of talk about what Peter just said about the whole idea of geek culture, and I just read an article this morning, and maybe Sean, you did too, where it was about how maybe we've gone too far with the geek culture, because I guess they had some sort of awards where Seth Green was the host and Stan Lee came out and did some stuff, and this article was very dismissive of that. And it was just sort of like, all right, we get it. Like, you weren't popular in high school and, you know, you liked reading comic books and someone made fun of you for reading comic books. And like, all right. But they were sort of saying in this article that, like, all right, geeks, you know, you're Pepsi, you're Budweiser. OK, like, you have a thing, you know, because I guess this whole awards was like everyone sort of patting themselves on the back for being a geek. And, you know, as much as I've aligned myself with being in that world, I gotta say, like, I sort of agreed with a lot of this article. It's like, all right, well, maybe, like, we're there now, like, we're cool, it's fine, like, everything's fine, like, we don't all need to sort of complain about our background so much. Like, we have found a lot of people in the world, particularly online, that like the kinds of things that we like, and let's all take that and move on.
Yeah, this kind of goes back to even the idea of the you know, what we now call just punks, or it arises in punk rock, but the punk movement, at least not necessarily as a music movement, but as a group, was actually a response to the commodification of the teens, because after the 50s, there was no teen market prior to that. There was no such thing as like a teen demographic, and then they created it, and all of these teens were like, oh, we got this whole thing, and they're selling shit to us, and then the punks were like, screw that. We're not interested in that anymore. And it was a rejection, not just against that, but more specifically to the sort of capitalism. But the irony is that same idea, the punk, and then the other variations that come out of it, ends up becoming commodified, just like geek has, where, you know, the geek, if you said you were a geek, you were the kind of the outsider. You weren't the in group. Now it's like, if you say you're a geek, it's okay. I mean, that doesn't mean – it doesn't have the same kind of, like, meaning. It's now almost like if you say it, you're a geek, it's almost like you just you say that you're – you know, you go to school. Like, it's not a big deal anymore. It doesn't seem to have the same power it used to have, where it's almost like a select social club of people who are mostly – bullied. I think at some point that's probably going to go away, where that won't be the narrative anymore about how geeks were bullied. It's going to be just individual people who were bullied, and the geeks will, because it's so mainstream now. I don't know. I see Peter wants to probably yell at me and call me stupid.
No, not at all. In fact, I think, gosh, we're coming up with lots of topics for new shows, Sean, because I think there's a whole show around the degree to which even inside — and I really don't want to go down this rabbit hole today — but inside geek culture, there is a mainstream. And if you sit at the periphery of that mainstream with some ideology of your own or something, you can be as sort of marginalized and victimized as the geeks once were. It's really fascinating to me. But back on what you originally were saying, you know, when I was going to high school, there was definitely sort of a geek click. And they didn't even self-refer that way, but they were the kids that were in the AV club and the Latin club and the chess club. And those sound very stereotyped, but that's definitely who those kids were. But even a smaller population were the metalheads. And sometimes they were called stoners, but they were pretty much the same kids. And at our school, at the north end of the school, there was this place called the Square. And it was just a small cement porch kind of deal. And that's where they would all congregate, and they would listen to Scorpions and, you know, whatever was popular at that time. And that was an even smaller group of kids that were just as sort of at the side of the rest of, you know, whatever was mainstream. So, you know, going back to the point I made earlier, I really see when we talk about the notion of a segment, and then tying that back to your comment around the commodification. You know, the same thing has happened to metal. And in my mind, it happened about the time that Metallica released Black, because there were some huge songs. When Enter Sandman, you know, went up for awards and they were playing at award shows and everybody was there. When I went to the Mindcrime, the first time that Queensryche played the Mindcrime, the full album in their tour, and it was a huge arena, 23,000 people, and it was going crazy. And after Jeff Tate finished singing first part of that set, he looked around the audience and he says, "Most of you right now are going, what the fuck is going on?" Because everybody came to see Silent Lucidity because they heard it on the radio. No one was there to hear Mindcrime. And it's just grown since then with this genre, where there's you know, it's more there's more acceptance. People will wear black and they'll throw the horns and they'll show up to a show by a band they've heard on the radio. And, you know, they can put their metal on for a night. And I endorse that. You know, that's great. But it's not, you know, it's not precisely where we began with Rebellion and, you know, trying to actually make a statement with lyrically. Because yes, there was a whole group that were just putting it on for show, but there's a lot of thoughtful people inside the metal community. And if you listen to some of them comment on things they care about and the things they write and sing about, it's very, very compelling. I won't bore you with the myriad examples, but trust me that's true.
Oh, I don't doubt it. John, you had your hand up first, so let's get you to jump in.
Well, to go back to what Peter said about in high school, like to just sort of wrap all the sort of geek and metal things sort of back to where we're going, I think, or up ahead to where we're going. When I was in high school, I played football and I wrestled and I was not popular at all, but I was sort of into sports. So I don't know if I would be considered a geek early on in high school, but when I was in middle school, I certainly was. And I was always, I was very smart and I always got good grades. And so even in high school, even when I tried to sort of be a jock to a certain extent, like I was still kind of too smart and, you know, so, and I still liked Star Wars and all that stuff. But the thing is that nowadays, as we've been talking about, it's fine to talk about that stuff and admit it. But in my early days of high school, you wouldn't have walked around saying, like, hey, isn't Star Wars great? Like, this is, you know, sort of 1988, 89, when my first couple years of high school, and, like, you would have been made fun of if you were talking about that stuff back in the day. And it wasn't really until later on, after I finished sports, and then I got became a musician, and I started playing in bands, and all, like, my sort of metal friends that we played in bands together, now we're getting into, like, 1991, 1992, I remember a moment where after we were sort of rehearsing in my friend's garage, where we went back into their house and they had a video of the Transformers movie from 1986. And one of us saw it and we're like, hey, you guys want to watch that? And we're like, yeah, let's watch that. Like, and we were sort of pretending that we were like kind of goof, like it was like a goof, but we were all like really into it. And we all sort of looked around at each other and we're like, okay, it's okay that we like this, right? Like, we're, you know, we're all 18 and we're into metal, but it's cool, right? It's okay. And sort of that was like the first moment where I reconnected with things that I liked when I was younger, and it was sort of okay. And it was sort of in this sort of community of music and of metal, and I think it does attract a lot of the same people. And then just to sort of wrap it around to where Peter was going, it's, I think a lot of times musicians tend to be pretty thoughtful and tend to think about lots of different things. So lyrically, you can get into deeper things, more interesting things. And I think the kind of person who is inspired enough to become a musician and to write their own music, and maybe it's in the vein of this sort of progressive rock or metal, is also someone that's attracted to whether it be Dungeons and Dragons or science fiction or fantasy literature. I think those people are the same, and quite often they inspire each other. And I think if you're kind of gluing together the literature and Dungeons and Dragons and metal and progressive rock specifically, you can really, what glues that all together, or one of the things that glues it all together, is the art. Quite often, I think the artwork on a metal album cover, or the artwork for D&D, or the artwork for a science fiction or fantasy novel, they are very similar, and I imagine a lot of times the same artist doing the same work. So it sort of really groups it all together.
All right, Paul, you had your hand up, so let's get you to jump in, and then we'll go back to Peter.
Yeah, John in some ways actually made my point for me. I'm going to come up from a slightly different angle. It occurred to me as Peter was talking about high school and geekdom and all these subcultures that there's a fractal complexity to the entire thing. You can drill down from geeks into different various subgenres of geeks, and so there's geeks that like metal, and then there are geeks that actually listen to something like Mindcrime, and some geeks will actually, like John, actually go on to play music, and these little spheres nesting inside of each other, all interacting with each other, like John was saying, with the art of Dungeons and Dragons, all these other sub-geekdoms in this fractal monstrosity that from the outside just looks, oh, they're all geeks, but inside, the deeper you go, the more complex and interwoven these little different subcultures are with each other. And you just can keep drilling down and down until you can find geekdoms of one, I would imagine, if you looked hard enough.
Yeah, perhaps. Peter?
You know, I wanted to go back to, because I'd love to start getting into some specifics now. Someone made a comment around the art. I think it was John. You know, Molly Hatchet had Frank Frazetta doing covers for their albums. You have only to pick up a Manowar album to like literally feel like you're looking at sort of a pulpy high fantasy, you know, book cover. The relationship between I happened to meet Thomas, who's the keyboard player for Nightwish, and the reason I met him is because he's a huge fan of Robin Hobb, and Robin Hobb lives here locally. And I had put up a song on my Facebook page one day. It was a Nightwish song. And she happened to read it that day because we're friends on Facebook. And she shot me a mail and said, hey, do you want to go to Nightwish? And I about dropped my drawers. Like, Robin Hobb, can you imagine? You get the picture. This astute, articulate, amazing writer woman is listening to Nightwish. I couldn't have been more dumbfounded and delighted. And so we went to, and she knows this guy personally. So I go backstage, I get to meet this guy, and he's this huge fan of Robin Hobb's, and have this really, really wonderful conversation between, you know, this orchestrator and this musician. and this fantasy writer, you know, and I chime in hopefully with something salient here and there, but you can kind of see where these groups begin to intersect. And there's no doubt if you look at the art and if you look, you know, you can look at the simple transferences with Led Zeppelin doing Tolkien stuff, and that's interesting. But I'm a bit more of a fan of those who are creating the narrative on their own. You know, I find that the inspiration of the themes, and I don't mean to be too high-minded about this, but, you know, we've talked before, Sean, I think when I was on the show before, we talked about the degree to which there's real commentary in a lot of fantasy fiction around race relations. And, you know, you can listen to a metal album and just rock, and that's perfectly acceptable. But it's great for me that a lot of these artists and these albums have layers that are, that the invitation is that you may explore them if you want. Just as the fantasy writers we know are doing the same thing. You can just go for a romp, or if you really want to pull it apart and see, you know, some of the feelings that the writer is imbuing in the work, it's there. And this is why it's such rich terrain, and I think why I'm such a fan.
Yeah, you keep bringing up Nightwish, and I really like Nightwish too. I'm not a huge metal person myself, but I really like them because they've got a female lead singer, and she's actually, well, they've switched singers now, so I don't know who the new singer is, but back, I forget what the album is I have, but their songs are really, really quite complicated from a musical perspective, because they're mixing all of these kinds of genres together, and as you say, like, if you just watch some of their music videos, they're so obviously, like, they're about fantasies and these larger narratives, and also about rocking, because the guy with the guitar is always busting, and he gets, like, fire shooting out of it and, like, stars and cool stuff, which is...
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. But Nightwish is a really good example, and I think... Because I suspect some people who listen to this are like, I hate metal, it sucks, and, like, listen to some Nightwish. You might like some Nightwish, because it's not what you... I guess most people would assume metal is, because they think they think death metal is what they think metal is. And Nightwish is like as far removed from death metal as I guess you could get. Although some death metal is quite interesting from a narrative perspective. So, yeah. So I just like Nightwish. That's all I had to say. I've got nothing interesting after that. John?
No, that's good.
Well, with metal, like anything else, we're probably just talking about drilling down into different things. You know, metal is very diverse, and there's just a million subgenres. And particularly a great highlight of this is if you watch Sam Dunn's now I can't remember the name of the series, but it was like a history of metal series on VH1, and just going through each episode was devoted to a different genre of metal, and you know it's everything. And they had a power metal episode where they talked about Nightwish and Rhapsody and other bands like that, but you know what I think happens in music sometimes, and now I think in the world, because everything so much is like a niche now, everything can sort of exist at the same time, but you know what I think happens is it sort of works in a cycle where things will start off somewhat simplistic, and each successive band or artist will get a little more complicated, a little more complicated, a little more complicated, where you get to progressive rock and you have Yes and Rush and Genesis and all that, and then there's a reaction against that complexity, and then you get punk, which is a reaction against progressive rock, amongst other things. And then punk sort of develops and does its thing. And then, you know, there's other stuff going on at the time. And then you get back into metal. And then in the 80s, you get sort of the more commercial 80s, you know, hair metal kind of stuff, which I liked a lot. And that gets maybe a little more complicated, maybe a little more glossy. And then grunge is a reaction against that. And it breaks it down. So you do have – so if you're thinking of metal in terms of just – Black Sabbath, or you know, something like death metal, or the Cookie Monster metal, as I call it, because you know, it's a shame too with that. Well, actually, it's a shame for me as a listener, because a lot of that stuff, I see someone talking about it online, and I'm like, oh, I'll go check out Amon Amarth. That sounds interesting. And then I go and I listen to it, and the first 30 seconds. Musically, I'm like, this is great. It sounds really cool and really complicated and heavy. And then they sort of come in with the Cookie Monster vocals, and I'm like, all right, I'm out. Like, it's just not appealing to me. It's a fine, it's an artistic choice, but it's not one that appeals to me. with metal, there are all the different subgenres, and there are many metal bands that have beautiful melodic singers and more thoughtful compositions than death metal or, you know, some more primitive kind of sounding metal. And then there's a place for that too, and there are people that love that too. But there's lots of great metal to listen to that if you didn't think you would like it. Now, you were mentioning Nightwish. Nightwish is a great example for someone who maybe doesn't like metal. And I know a lot of people that like Nightwish that don't really like anything else that's particularly metal. But there's lots of other stuff like Nightwish. There is all the power metal stuff that has those sort of operatic vocals, and it is distinctly European, I think, a lot of times, because people, Europeans do have a background of listening to classical music and listening to opera, even if they maybe weren't a big fan themselves, they sort of grew up listening to that in their houses, so they want those big anthemic choruses, and they want that, you know, beautiful singing, so, you know, other bands to check out, if in addition to Nightwish, would be Blind Guardian, Rhapsody, although there's like two versions of Rhapsody now. There's like Rhapsody and Rhapsody of Fire, but these sort of blends of metal and classical music and sort of classical composition and more operatic singing. And if you like Nightwish, those are two other bands that I think you would probably dig too.
And it should be noted that at least I don't know about the current lead singer, but the previous lead singer for Nightwish is actually classically trained.
I think most of those singers are. You can usually tell.
Yeah, and they've actually done they did a really great rendition of the Phantom of the Opera, that main song from it, but like, you know, metal version, and it was kind of badass. So
yeah,
I recommend people watch it. It's kind of awesome. I know, Peter, you wanted to jump in on what John was saying here.
Yeah, several things. So yeah, Tara, who was the first singer for Nightwish, did the Phantom piece, and they did a great job. They've had three singers. It is true that a great many of the singers, particularly in the progressive metal, have done training. Sometimes it's super obvious. The technique kind of really comes through. Other times they're really just leveraging the technique and creating it in more of a popular fashion. A good example of that in sort of what I consider kind of grunge metal is Alice in Chains. Lane Staley was trained classically just as much as Tara or Flora, any of those singers for Nightwish were. It's also true that so much of metal, to John's point, gets lumped together, and they kind of hear Iron Man or Smoke on the Water and think, yeah, I know what that is. I don't like that. But the diversity is pretty amazing. And it's why I started, I think, saying I don't consider myself a metalhead, because I don't listen to every genre, nor do I like every genre. I did a tour through Europe with a band. And I was in Germany. I was in Germany doing a show, and I was looking at a Hard Rock magazine there, and there were literally some pictures of Ritual Slayings from some of the death metal bands. It was disturbing, and I think that's an extreme. They're not all doing that, of course, but there's a culture for each of these sort of houses in the mansion, as Paul is saying. And I think that I would really encourage people to seek out do enough tasting that they can find something they might like, because music discovery is important, you know, and this is kind of a soapbox of mine. A good entry point can be the things that John's talked about. And if people are interested in really melodic stuff, I would point them to some of the Dream Theater content.
Yes.
It's not, Dream Theater is probably my all-time favorite band. These are Juilliard grads. They're Berklee School of Music grads. These are people who are as fine a musicians. I mean, the stories go on for days of music students dragging their professors to Dream Theater concerts to show them the musicianship level of these players. New bands, if people want to go and kind of dive in on something, there's a band called Wolverine that's fairly new. They've got an album called Communication Lost that is so melodic. You don't have to like metal at all. I guarantee you that this album is going to sort of hit notes inside you that will resonate. Another fairly recent band called Circus Maximus.
And they're great, yeah.
The instrumentation is so well put together that I think any person who appreciates fine musicianship are going to listen to these bands and really, really, you know, love them. A couple others that I know Therion, a band called Sonata Arctica, a band called Stradivarius. There's a lot of bombast in these, but, you know, I know writers who use these to write to when they do their big fight and war and battle scenes, because they're like movie scores. And so sometimes it'll be called epic orchestral music. But it takes that theme, that very cinematic theme, it puts it against a narrative, and I tell you, it will give you chills. And this is all in the metal world. It's a soapbox for me, because I hate that the category is dismissed in the same way that I hate fantasy is dismissed, because some people think it's got a wizard and so it's not for me. We know that's not true, and so I love pointing people to examples of music and fiction that is that doorway to new experiences. It's a passion of mine.
Yeah, and I think, like, this has been one of my weird moments when people ask me, like, what kind of music do you like? And I'm like, I don't even know how to answer that question, because I listen to almost a little bit of everything, because I just find the stuff that I like that's in each of those genres. So, like, if somebody says, like, do you like rock music? I'm like, well, I like some rock music. I don't like Nickelback, but, you know, I don't know if that's rock music anymore. That's a terrible example.
I have one point on what Peter was going to say, and then what you just said, Sean. First of all, to get to Dream Theater, and Peter knows I'm a big Dream Theater fan too. When Dream Theater's Images and Words album came out, that was everything that I wanted in music. It was sort of like that would have been the album that I would have wanted to make at that time, because it was... It was metal, but it was much more melodic than metal typically was. The singing was great, and the guitar playing was of the virtuoso variety that I was really into at the time. So John Petrucci was sort of the first guy in a band, in my opinion, that really was at that level of Steve Vai and Joe Satriani and Yngwie Malmsteen. And because usually those guys were sort of relegated to doing a lot of just instrumental music on their own, or they were like a hired gun in Steve Vai's case, where when he played with David Lee Roth, and I loved all that stuff. But to sort of have this thinking man's music and have it be really melodic and really well produced and orchestrated and arranged, and then to have this, you know, virtuoso guitar playing and a great use of the synthesizers, and it's just, it was everything that I wanted to hear in music, and I still love that album. I was just listening to it the other day. Well, Peter, why don't you go, because I'm going to go down a different path now.
Well, I can't let conversation around Dream Theater pass without chiming in. They are my favorite band on the planet. They're my, you know, desert island band. And what John's saying is in spades, right? I mentioned that these guys graduated from school. Petrucci, there are YouTube videos of this where he would start with just a basic scale with a metronome, and he increases that metronome until it can't go any higher, and he's keeping perfect time. Now, that's a very mechanical, you know, approach to practice. The difference between Petrucci and a guy like Yngwie Malmsteen, and I respect the hell out of Yngwie. He did a lot to popularize virtuoso guitar. He's classically trained, all of that. Certainly got, you know, his share of ego behind all of that too. But when I listen to a guy like Petrucci, he takes all of that ability and he makes it musical in a way that most of the guitar players who are playing at that level of virtuosity don't, in my opinion. And the what's unique about Dream Theater is it's the same for every player at every instrument. James LeBrie, who sings for that band, and by the way, to keep it relevant to the conversation, these guys have done concept albums about past life regression that are super fantastical and fun. They have epic songs that are 23 minutes that do the same thing. But James LeBrie, who sings for them, is another classically trained vocalist, absolutely amazing talent. And he's a guy that can move between. He actually did an album with a couple of opera tenors, that's a really interesting listen if you ever get a chance. But he can move from a very, very lush, you know, quiet, intimate sound to something that's just completely mind blowing in the note that he hits, with the clarity and the power he can hit it. Me, as a vocalist personally, you know, I'm a bit of a snob in this regard. I'm like John. I don't like Cookie Monster vocals. I can appreciate the instrumentation that sits behind them, but I can't listen to it because it's not an art form that is, you know, that speaks to me. There are plenty that it does, and I'm happy for those folks, just as there's a lot of people who won't listen to Dream Theater. But I think my meta point on this is that as a category, there's music that resides inside this metal family that I think I would take a challenge for someone who hates metal to find them a song by a metal artist they would like. Guarantee I can do it. And I would take the same challenge with somebody who sort of turns their nose up at genre fiction. I can point them to I feel confident I can point them to a work that they would enjoy as a piece of literature. And, you know, for me, that's that when I distill down a lot of this conversation, it kind of gets to that. Because I reject the notion that these forms of art aren't relevant simply because people believe stereotypically that they appeal to a small segment. I think that's an unfortunate viewpoint.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that kind of goes to a conversation that happens quite a lot, and even just specifically within like science fiction and fantasy, where people say, "I only read this one thing, and that's the only thing I will ever read." And then they get really defensive when people are like, well, you know, maybe you should like broaden your horizons a little, try some new stuff. And it's like, well, why should I? And it's like, well, because that should be, it should be about exploration to some extent. Right. And to your point about recommendations, I think it's one of the interesting things about recommendations is like in genre, the genre community, we get this thing where people go, you know, books you'd recommend to someone who's not a genre reader. And I always hate those lists because they always just ignore the fact that there's a reason why these people aren't reading or think they're not reading genre, because they like a certain thing. So if you're going to point a genre book to them, you need to know what they already like. And that's the same with something like metal, right? Like there are a lot of different kinds of metal that have kind of linkages to other types of music. So if you find out the kind of stuff they do like to listen to, you could probably find a thing in any genre of music that has a link in some way so that you can give them that gateway into this new thing. But it goes down to you have to actually know what they like before you can sort of start making those recommendations. Because I think it's really kind of pointless to make here, listen to this thing. But like, what if they hate anything that's in English and you send them something in English? Like, you're not helping your cause. That's a really terrible example. But
no, I understand what you're saying, because I think that I've heard too many conversations in lobby bars at cons where you know, people get a bit on a high horse around others that aren't reading fantasy and they shoo it a bit. And they say, if they would only read Tolkien. And I'm like, you know what? For a lot of people, that would be the wrong book to put into their hand if you want to introduce them to fantasy, as much as I might personally love Tolkien. And the same would be true. I would not give my mom a Metallica album. She would hate it. But guarantee you, I could give my mom some Dream Theater songs and she would love them. You know, there's an open-mindedness, and I don't mean to sound, you know, again, too high-minded about it, but there's that I think it encourages me when someone says, sure, you know, I'll listen to it and give it a try. And, you know, I pass them along something and they come back and say, hey, that was actually pretty good. You know, they're really surprised. It reminds me, I've written one nonfiction book in my life that's unreleased. His title is Jesus Had Long Hair Too, and it goes through the travails of being a male who has long hair, and you know there's an entire chapter around that's based on that one idea. I remember an older woman that I know have known all my life and loved to death, and when I grew my hair out, it was super hard for her because it's just not the thing that she could accept. And the way she finally reconciled herself, because she was a religious person, is she pulled me aside and whispered that very phrase in my ear. And you know what? I wasn't offended a bit, because I thought, if the touch point for you is that, then great. And so touch point then being sort of my Uber point in, there's a way for us to share the things we're passionate about, which is, you know, what we do in the community. In a way that's relevant for the person that we want to pass it along to. And that's why we get together in these podcasts and we get together at cons. We're sharing the things that we're passionate about. And it's why, you know, I applaud you for having conversations like this, because I think it gives us a chance to have the dialogue. So,
yep. All right, John, you get the last comment, and then we got to close out.
Okay, well, then I'll make it a light one that really just speaks to Peter's long hair. I had long hair, very long hair, like down to my waist between ages 16 and my early 20s, like 23 or so. And I remember when – mine never looked as good as Peter's does. I had stringy, greasy hair. It looked horrible. But anyway, and I did have a beard at one point too. So when I was like 21, I had very long hair and a beard, and I did look very, very Jesus-like at that time. But I remember when I finally cut it off, my parents, who never gave me crap about it, were always just like, that's fine, like, you're doing great in school, you're not doing drugs, like, they were always, they didn't like it, but they never gave me guff about it. But when I did get a cut, my dad shook my hand and said, like, you look so much better. So that was my long hair experience. But anyway, yeah. So I don't know. We could talk about this all day. And then I've really, Sean, thank you for inviting me on. And it's been just a pleasure to talk to you and to Peter again and Paul as well to talk about this stuff. We could probably do a whole podcast series on just every little thing about music and how it relates to genre and otherwise. So thank you for thinking of this.
Yeah, not a problem. So, okay. So really quick, just so everybody knows where people can find you and all that stuff. So Peter, just briefly tell us about your work, where people can find you online, that kind of thing.
Well, I'm writing a fantasy series for Tor, Epic Fantasy. The first book, entitled The Unremembered, is out. The second book has been turned in. I'm just awaiting a publication date. So that's my sort of writing life. I have released a bunch of short fiction set in that world if people kind of want to get a sense of what that is. And then you can find information about that, as well as a whole bunch of music, on my website, which is just my last name, Arulian.com. I'm on Twitter at Peter Arulian. And I will say, I don't know when this particular episode will air, but I just, with my writing partner last night, finished the final mix on a new tune, a new metal tune to sort of promote the recent anthology Unfettered that will release next week. So as people are probably listening to this, they can turn on and see what kind of music I make.
That's awesome. Yeah, yeah. I'll make sure people know where to go to your website and get your book and check out the music as well. When this goes up, the music may be out, so I can put a link to it.
Excellent.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, not a problem.
Thank you for inviting me. This has been a hell of a lot of fun.
Excellent. Not a problem. All right, John, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and where people can find you too?
Oh, well, I write songs and I compose instrumental music as well. And you can find everything. You know, if you just Google Anelio, which is A-N-E-A-L-I-O, you'll find all my stuff. But it's johnanelio.com. I have a lot of music up on my website there. And it's also on iTunes and Spotify and all that jazz. So that's my music side. And I also co-host a podcast called The Functional Nerds with Patrick Hester. And we talk about lots of different stuff. Our guests are usually science fiction and fantasy authors as well, so if you like listening to Skiffy and Fanti, you would probably like some of the stuff that we do as well. So there you go. And that's just functionalnerds.com, and you can put Functional Nerds into iTunes and you'll find us there as well.
Excellent. Perfect. All right, guys. Well, thank you both for coming on, especially on your Saturday morning. And thanks, Paul, for showing up kind of late notice. This is good. We only, I think, scratched the surface, so we may have to do another episode at some point to talk about stuff other than metal, because we've scraped a little bit of the paint off on the metal can. But thank you, Peter, for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you, John, for the same.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Sean.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
And thank you, Paul.
Absolutely.
And we'll see everybody next time. Bye.
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 If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanti@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanti.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanti.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanti Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.